You're listening to Last Word Radio, where you get the last word.
Welcome to the greatest hockey podcast the medieval world has ever seen. We're here on the power play with Colton Prale and Ben Kerr. Colton, how you doing tonight?
Honestly, amazing. Now I think you did that better than the Vegas announcer. That was great.
That, yeah, I mean, we're coming to you, we're recording during the Vegas and Winnipeg game 3, so we may not, we'll update as we go, but we don't know who's going to win this game, and those listening to the podcast obviously do. But we're going to start talking about that intro, because that was something. That was 4 minutes of just incredible, misery. Incredible production that I thought I'd never see. I think to top it all off, the best way to top it off is that they had the United States Air Force do a flyover of an event that is held in an indoor stadium.
Tax dollars at work. Love it, Americans.
Yes, because, I mean, everyone inside the stadium did not see the jet fly over top at all.
That was painful. Like, I sat there. I missed the intro live. So I went back and I watched it back right after the period or during the period. And it was just painful. There were parts that were intriguing. You know, like I watched the first intro with the Kings, and that was kind of like neat, but at the same time, really cheesy. But as it's gone on and on, part of me loves it. Part of me is like, yes, embrace the cheese. There's great production value-ish here. Sure. But the other part of me is like, this is so lame. This is just so... so terrible.
I mean, I know they're an expansion team and they weren't around for these two events, but there's two big things that that this recalls for me. The first, of course, is the Senator Spartan, and just how bad that was. And we had the 10-year anniversary of that. The Athletic did a whole in-depth conversation with the people involved, with the actor who played the Spartan, with the people who wrote the script, and what was supposed to happen and what went wrong. And I just don't know how, if you had seen that, how you could possibly think that tonight would be a good idea.
It wasn't. It just wasn't. I mean, we were talking about this earlier. At least they moved the script upstairs. You know, it's no longer on the back of the shield for everyone to see. But this was just, it's such a bad idea. In the worst part, and maybe it's just us. Maybe we're just cynical. But, like, I'm going on Reddit, and there's a lot of positive comments about it, people enjoying this. And I'm just curious who these people are.
I think these are the people who pay $50 for dinner at Medieval Times.
Oh, you know, Medieval Times is way more fun. I've been there like 6 times, 1,000 times better than this.
Okay, now I'll give you that. Medieval Times, when I was in high school, was a lot more enjoyable than this was. but the second thing it brought up was the NHL a few years ago contracted Stan Lee to do something called the Guardian Project, and it was an NHL All-Star Weekend, and every team had a guardian, and like it went on for like 10 minutes I can't remember now if it was before the All-Star game or before the skills competition, but that's neither here nor there. Anyways, it was 10 minutes. It was some type of epic showdown like this with some evil entity and the 30 guardians coming together to fight him. And it was never heard from again.
Because it was the worst decision the NHL has ever made.
So I think that this was like slightly better than that. I'm still putting the Senators' decision and then their Spartan against the Penguins as the worst decision of all time. But this was up there. This is probably in between the two.
I've blocked the sentence moment out of my mind. That's just didn't happen.
I mean, it had everything tonight. We had ice jousting. We had a man get sucked up by a cable into the rafters and reappear as a jet.
You know what? I will say that was kind of cool. Not the reappearing as a jet, just how quickly that man went off the ice. Like, he was just gone.
It was the reverse Shawn Michaels, as I called it.
You know what the worst part is? We've only been going for about a minute longer than that entire intro lasted.
Oh, Jesus. It was something. What else was featured there? The arrows, the holographic arrows.
Oh, yeah, that didn't transition well at all for me. I was hoping they'd just, like, actually shoot them onto the ice, but no.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't great.
There was the line about dining on shark.
I chuckled at that, actually. Feasting on shark made me chuckle.
Yeah. There was... and we've gone over the flyover. There was the drum line, which seems to be a part of a lot of Vegas games. I think that's part of their regular intro.
Yeah, I don't mind the drum line. The flyover and the slicing the jet in half was a little weird.
Yeah, the slicing the jet in half was, yeah, a little weird. And the dude was definitely dressed up as the 2018 Vegas version of the Spartan.
Yeah, a little more clothes on.
Yeah, a little more clothes on, but he definitely had that look with the helmet and everything. I mean, I just want to know who was behind this and who's getting fired for it tomorrow.
Oh, no, this is promotion worthy. This is definitely promotion worthy.
Anyways, well, my theory, I think your theory was that the Vegas Golden Knights were fired up by this intro.
Yeah.
My theory is that the Vegas Golden Knights had seen this intro several times in advance during rehearsals and were fully prepared for it. And the Jets were standing around looking at each other going, WTF. For 35 seconds as the game began, Jonathan Marchessault went in on a breakaway and scored. And it was 1-0 Vegas Golden Knights very early in this hockey game.
Vegas has done such a good job of shutting play down through the middle. If we're talking about that goal, just a little transition from one blue line to the other was so smooth. And obviously that hasn't happened every time all series, but they've just done such a good job of stopping zone entries. I think that's what's really been the difference in game two and so far in game three.
Well, I look at this series as a continuation of the Nashville and Jets series in many ways. There was the one game where the Nashville got the 3-0 lead and blew it. But the other six games was all about who could get the early lead totally shutting down the other team once you had a lead. And that was the way the Nashville and Winnipeg series went, with the exception of game three. And that's been the way the first two games in this series have been. Vegas, not sure where they finished, if it was 19 or 20 shots in game one, but they could not get their transition game going after the Jets came out to the early lead in game one. And then we saw the opposite story in game two, where the Vegas got the early lead and the Knights could not get anything going through the neutral zone.
I think what it really shows is that you don't need to be a super big, strong team to shut down speed and skill. You know, yes, Winnipeg is a big, heavy team, but I wouldn't say the Knights are the biggest or the heaviest. They're just quick,
they're so
using
fast.
That speed
yeah,
so well.
They are not a big team overall. I don't have the stats in front of me, but I know they're not in the top 10 bigger and heavier teams in the NHL. They are probably in the top 10, if not the top 5 fastest teams for an entire lineup. I rarely see a team with a fourth line with as much speed as Vegas has. And that just goes through. It's right from line 1 to line 4.
I don't want to say Jonathan Marchessault's speed is underrated, but the number of times he's blown past the defender and gone forehand, backhand on the goalie, just this series, is astonishing. Like, he is so much quicker than people give him credit for, and he's already known as a fast player.
The other one, yeah, and I, in some ways, I get how Florida gave up on him, and I get how Tampa gave up on him because of size.
Do you get how Florida gave up on him? It's $750K for a 30-goal scorer. Like, just, I don't...
Yeah, I know.
I'm gonna sidetrack this, but yeah, like, I get how Tampa gave up. I get how, you know, he's gone through so many teams-ish to a point. I get it. I just, Florida's the only one I don't understand because, I mean, 30 goals is 30 goals, and it's less than $1 million.
Okay.
But yeah, anyways, continue.
Okay, I was going on Florida, though. You kind of sidetracked me here.
I know.
What I really don't get, is that Florida was so desperate to get rid of Riley Smith that they threw in Jonathan Marchessault and made a trade with the Knights to give up more than just Riley Smith. And I don't get why they wanted to get rid of Riley Smith either, because I've watched this, and I understand, I've seen the quotes from Dale Tallon where why they gave up Marchessault, and they didn't believe in his defensive game, and they said defense wins championships, and they wanted to keep their defensive core together and things like that. But Riley Smith, to me, is quickly becoming one of the best defensive forwards in the National Hockey League. I don't think Marchessault is a great defensive player. I don't think he's as bad as Dale Tallon made him out to be, but I don't think he's a great defensive player. But he's so insulated because Riley Smith is an outstanding penalty killer. He's the first one over the boards for the Golden Knights every time they take a penalty. They're able to play this line with Carlson, who's also a very good defensive player, and Riley Smith against the Scheifele line, against the Sharks' top line, against the Kopitar line with the Kings, against every team's top line. And that's the part that astounds me, is with the Dale Tallon comments about, you know, he wanted to keep his defensive players together. He didn't think Marchessault was good enough defensively. Well, you used Marchessault to basically get rid of one of your top defensive forwards.
Yep. I don't have a counter argument for you because there's really nothing to say to that. That makes it better. You know, I get it to a point. We don't like Riley Smith because he's an expensive 20-goal scorer. But, I mean, he's proven he can be more than that. He's proven he's got a two-way game. He's proven he can get up to 30. He's, you know, he's a very competent player, and maybe you were paying a little higher than you'd like to be, but, I mean, it wasn't outrageous. It certainly, I wouldn't say, is over market value for the player that he is. There's definitely another team who's going to be willing to have paid that salary for him if that was such a big issue that you absolutely needed to get rid of him. And then the other thing that I'd add is, does defense win championships? Like, yes, it certainly can. But if we look at the teams who have won in the last few years, especially Pittsburgh, Chris Letang wasn't even in their cup run last year. Look at this year. The Golden Knights have Braden McNabb, Derek Englund, Lucas Spezza.
Jeff Schultz, Theodore.
Shea Theodore is a good defenseman, but he's certainly not defensive. Mm-hmm. Nate Schmidt's a good two-way guy, but I wouldn't classify him as a defenseman either. I mean, outside of Schmidt, I would argue there is not a top two defenseman on that team. Maybe Theodore develops into one. Maybe.
Yeah, but he's not there yet. He could develop into one, absolutely, but he's not there yet. And we just had the Jets tied up.
Oh, I am definitely on a delay. So I want to thank you for ruining that for me. can't wait to see it.
The fans on a delay listening to this podcast are very...
They're few and far between. It's just me. It's actually just me.
That I ruined it for, yes.
That's all right. I'll get there in about a minute and a half. But until then...
I won't tell you who. I won't give you the name of the goal scorer.
perfect. I appreciate that. It'll be a nice little surprise. But I guess my point is here that, like, there are more than one ways to win a championship. And the teams who are in the Final Four right now aren't particularly strong defensively. No, Washington is not. Tampa is not. Winnipeg, I would say, is. And Vegas is not. You do not need the Predators' blue line to win the Stanley Cup.
No, if you
build the right way.
No, and we've got another goal, but I won't tell you which team scored the quick goal after the Jets goal.
Well, I only just saw Mark Scheifele, so
we've got another quick one right after. Anyways, the Washington Capitals have John Carlson, who some thought was gypped of a Norris Trophy domination. I don't believe that.
Yes,
he was the highest scoring defenseman in the NHL, but I don't think he deserved a Norris. He's not that good defensively. And then they've got guys like Matt Niskanen and Dmitry Orlov are basically their top pair against other teams' best lines. You've got guys like Brooks Orpik still playing a big role in that defense. I don't see them. I see them as an average NHL defense. I don't think they're bad, but I don't think they're great. Tampa I do like, because Victor Hedman playing half the game. To me, Victor Hedman's the best defenseman in the NHL this season. Should win the Norris. So I like that. I do like Anton Strahlman on their second pair. But you've also got Dan Girardi playing on the top pair. You've got Mikhail Sergachev getting big minutes for them. They do have Ryan McDonagh as well. I mean, the Lightning do have a pretty good defense, and I think the Jets have one of the best defenses in hockey. They matched up very well in that series with Nashville.
No, I mean, I agree with that with Tampa. I think I was perhaps underrating them. I forgot a bit about Strahlman, who I shouldn't, because I loved in New York, and I've loved since he's joined the Lightning. And Sergachev has definitely played a big role in kind of shoring up the two-way side of that game. I will say that second goal from the Knights was freaking horrendous from Hellebuck.
Yeah.
Not sure what he was going for there. But no, you're right. I would say Tampa's defense is probably in the higher end of the league. But
when you think of all these teams, I mean, the one thing these teams all have in common is incredible depth up front.
Yeah, it's all a high powered offense, and lines and lines of offense. You know, it's the ability to score with your fourth line. It's guys like Chandler Stephenson stepping up in the playoffs, who no one would have expected. It's
Lars Eller filling in for Nick Backstrom and playing extremely well in the playoffs. I think we see Nick Backstrom back in Game 4. I don't know that for sure, but that's my feeling, is that Nick Backstrom will be back. But that's the type of lineup that you have. You have Kuznetsov with Ovechkin. You have Backstrom and Oshie. You have Lars Eller and Brett Connolly on that third line. Tampa, of course, with the Braden Point, you know, the amazing first line. Braden Point on the second line. Tyler Johnson, Andre Palat on the third line. Tampa's known for this deep offense. We know how deep the Vegas team is. That's one of their strengths. Guys like, we talked about their first line, but guys like Holla, James Neal, David Perron, who's not playing tonight, Alex Tuck, all these players who put up big numbers for them. And the Jets also have three really strong lines. When your third line centered by Brian Little, you know you've got a pretty strong lineup.
Even guys like Adam Lowry or Copper or Mia are all significant upgrades for most teams' bottom six.
Oh, absolutely. I think Joel Armia would play in the top line, in top nine, possibly the top six on a number of NHL teams. And he's a fourth line winger.
And that's just it. I mean, this is. And so I guess that's where I kind of. I don't buy into Dale Talon's excuse. I think those moves were fueled by a need to purge the Florida Panthers of the previous regime, and it just, you know, maybe that's overreaching or, you know, projecting onto the team. But that's how I read it, because I don't think from a hockey sense that there's really a justifiable response.
No, I think the Florida Panthers offseason last year was built on purging money, to be honest with you.
That's fair.
If that's what I got the sense of from the Florida Panthers moves, from letting go guys like Jeremy Jagr and letting him walk, even though that turned out to look like a pretty good hockey decision, it was one based on money to begin with for me, and them going and getting a cheaper player out of Russia in Evgeny Dadonov, who actually was one of their better players this year, and that is actually a good hockey move for them. But that, who is the defenseman they gave up? To Phoenix, I think. Just.
You think Demers?
Yeah, Demers. That was just a move based solely on money, and didn't make a lot of sense either analytically or even from the eye test. I didn't get that move. We've got another goal in Vegas. not a lot of sense in Florida's offseason last year, and the way that they seemingly looked to dump money.
I understand that they're an internal cap team, especially being a Sens fan. I totally get some of the ramifications that has on your ability to build a contending team. I just think there were some misevaluations in the way that they did it. Do you want to talk Lightning and Capitals? Because I think that series has been intriguing, especially with the Lightning kind of pulling things back and really shutting down Washington's offense last night. And a lot of that comes through the fact that Vasilevsky stood on his head. But I was impressed with their performance after being kind of disappointed in the first two games.
Well, to me, the first two games I thought were pretty even in terms of play. But Braden Holtby badly outplayed Andrei Vasilevsky in the first two hockey games in that series, and that led to two big wins for the Capitals. Vasilevsky, to me, I had mentioned this in our department chat. I thought he looked like a goalie who was running out of gas in that series. We all know that he's played, I believe he's up to 78 games now this year, and his previous career high playoffs and regular season was about 50. That was including his time in Russia, and he never really played in the AHL as an AHL starter either. So it was a big jump in games for Vasilevsky, and I felt like he had hit the wall, and some of the stats were behind that as well. This was a guy who was a surefire Vezina winner at the All-Star break, who faded badly down the stretch. He came back last night. He looked excellent last night, but I question how many games he can keep that up.
Yeah, I think that's a fair question, especially with the number of pucks that were fired his way last night, not even just on net, but just his way in general. I don't know, part of that's from score effects, but the Caps really came on strong in the latter half of the second period and into the third. I think you've got a really solid point about just fatigue and tiredness. He's a young goalie who really hasn't had an experience like this in his career. And I don't just mean the moment. I mean having to be this strong. I think going directly into that NHL backup role kind of ruined the chance for him to get used to the North American schedule down the stretch. You know, it's one of those things where if he plays 60 games and doesn't make the postseason, then maybe he's a little tired, but he's at least getting used to it. And this is a pretty big jump for him. And I think part of that comes from their decision to go with Louis Domingue as a backup. I think had Tampa had better options, perhaps we're not having this discussion right now.
Well, they're supposed to have Peter Budaj. And all indications are that Peter Budaj is a pretty solid backup before this season and was capable of handling some of that load. The way he had played the previous season in L.A. should have indicated that. But he just did not get the job done.
Yeah, that's fair. It was a bet that I probably would have made as well with Budaj. I mean, he's been good. but good for backup, I should say. And like, yeah, LA probably wasn't going to repeat itself, especially in that kind of role that he played there. But it's a fair bet, but it's one that didn't pan out. And then you're left with a guy like Lou Dimming, who really, even in Phoenix, wasn't that great, or Arizona, I should say, wasn't, you know, outstanding. He didn't really turn many heads.
No, and Vasilevskiy was coming off a 50-game season with all of Ben Bishop's injuries and Ben Bishop being traded at the deadline in the 2016-17 season. Vasilevskiy had basically spent one full season as the starter. But again, as you mentioned, it was a season where they missed the playoffs.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where it's like, look, he's young, and by no means are we disappointed, I think, in his performance, especially his first half performance. You know, it's just one of those things that he's going to have to learn and understand his physical limits, you know, and what's it going to mean if they do make it to the next round. You know, what condition is he going to be in? It's something that the Lightning will have to plan for in the future.
So with the results in these playoffs, with Alexander Ovechkin playing so well, with Marc-Andre Fleury playing so well, with results like that, are we finally able to bury the clutch myth once and for all?
I think so. I think you're always going to have certain players who inexplicably break the rule and perpetuate clutch stereotypes. Looking at you guys like Briere. That said,
but even then, Briere's his playoff scoring is like 110% of his regular season score in 5-on-5.
Yeah, which is
it's not that big. It's
but he played a decent number of playoff games. For me, it's a significant enough jump that it's noticeable. You know, like his points per game goes up enough that I think you could argue Danny Briere does find an extra gear in the playoffs, or has just been incredibly fortuitous. But I'm fine if you want to argue the man finds an extra gear. That said, as a whole, I don't believe in clutch. I just don't. You know, you've got those ISO guys who have, or people claim to have, the ability. But on the whole, more often than not, the guys who are clutch are the guys who are put out in situations to succeed. You know, Justin Williams scoring in Game 7 all the time. Is it a fact that he is Mr. Game 7? Or just that he's given a ton of offensive situations in Game 7s based on past history? You know, based on the fact that he's actually just a good goal scorer all of the time, you know, is.
Yeah, the Justin Williams thing's one where I look at it and go, you know what? Game 6 is an elimination game. Game 6, you're either taking the series or you're extending it to 7. And he underperforms his career stats in Game 6s.
That's just it. Like, I just don't believe it.
His overall playoff stats are pretty much equal to his overall regular season stats. Claude Lemieux's points per game are identical in the playoffs versus the regular season. And if you look at each of his playoff years versus what he did in the regular season that year, he has 10 playoffs where he overperforms his season and 10 playoffs where he underperforms his season.
Continue.
No rhyme or reason to these guys who get called clutch. And to me, you know, there's Fernando Pisani who goes and does it for one playoff year. But if you're so clutch, how come you suddenly can't start scoring goals when you know your career is on the line and you're about to be waived if you don't start scoring? Where's the clutch for your personal career and personal accomplishments?
And that's just it. It's entirely based on when these guys did it. And I say did because it's entirely past tense. You cannot be clutch if you haven't scored in a clutch moment. It's one of those things that we apply retroactively and only when it fits.
Mm-hmm.
It just is. Is Andrew Shaw clutch? No. Did people sell Andrew Shaw's clutch after he scored a game-winning goal in the Stanley Cup final? Yes.
Yeah, and
we decide when it applies and when it doesn't. It's BS.
Yeah, and it's just something that I've argued with so many people so many times. I've wasted so many hours on the internet arguing about clutch.
I can't see that at all.
I've wasted so many hours of my life on the internet arguing about clutch and sports. And
people, I mean, there's certain guys, you know, James Harden in the NBA, I think legitimately does have a clutch factor. He shoots like 60%, you know, in the final 30 seconds. I also just think James Harden is really good at shooting basketballs.
Yeah.
You know, I think you give these guys enough moments. You give these elite players enough moments, enough opportunities. And they're going to show you why they're who they are, why they're great at the sport.
Yeah, and it's the Joe Sakic argument about Joe Sakic being the leading all-time NHL overtime goal scorer in the playoffs. And I just look at it as, here's a guy who scored, what, like 690 career NHL goals? Yeah, he scored a lot in the playoffs and overtime. He also scored a lot in the regular season when it was a 4-1 game to make it 5-1 for the Avalanche. He just was a good goal scorer.
It's just the way hockey goes. I'm with you on this one. I really don't buy into it. I also don't buy into the Rick Nash stories of guys who can't get it done. Again, I think there are individuals, and I think in this case, maybe Rick Nash is one. But when these players make it to this level of competition, they've dealt with pressure before. And if you aren't able to deal with pressure, if you flop in the biggest moments, you're not going to be able to make it to the NHL for the most part, unless you are just so undeniably skilled that it didn't matter, that you were so good, things just went your way, even when you weren't performing your best in the biggest moments, it's probably fine.
Yeah.
Because all these guys have dealt with pressure before. All these guys have dealt with game sevens, with big moments, with finals, with championships, with titles.
With the first time the scouts showed up at one of their games.
That's just it. They've all had to perform at a certain moment in their life.
You know, at the time when you were a rookie and trying to make the team out of training camp and you had to outperform some veteran to get that spot. There's pressure in those moments. Maybe there's not 30,000 people or 20,000 people in the stadium and another million micro-analyzing it the way they're doing in the playoff, in the Stanley Cup playoffs, but in your own head, there's a pressure there. I think the part of it is we want to see these athletes as superhuman, which in many ways they are. I mean, they can do things that we can't do in our beer leagues. And so there's this idea of being clutch makes them more of like a superhero, when to me, just being as insanely talented as they are makes them that superhero. The other thing is we want to relate it to our own experiences. And we've all seen in our beer leagues the guy who chokes with the open net with 4 seconds left. Or on the golf course, the guy who misses the putt because $50 is on the line, or the first round of beers is on the line in the clubhouse. And we think that pros experience the same kind of pressure, just magnified when it's a putt for $1 million or whatever it is. But it's just not there. The guys who failed long before they got to that point.
That's exactly it. And I want to touch on that superhuman note. Yeah, we do want to see these guys as superior or as, you know, extraordinary out of this world. But I think it's important to look at them not as superhuman or you know, almost like a deity. They are just peak performance humans. These are guys who have mastered certain physical elements and who were born with, you know, these abilities and then trained these abilities to be even better. But they're by no means different than you or I. You know, it's the same motions, the same muscle movements, the same twitches, just performed faster, better, stronger. And at the end of the day, it's important to remember that, because they are human. They're still going through similar emotions. They've just trained themselves to deal with it better. They've just faced that $50 putt 1,000 more times than you have, you know, and they've learned how to ignore it and how to avoid it. It's not that they don't face this pressure.
Yeah.
They've just been there before. It's not new.
Yeah, no, I agree with all that. And I think we should go back to the Jonathan Marchessault question. I think clearly heightism was an issue, and the idea that small players can't succeed in the NHL was an issue. And I just want to say that at Last Word on Hockey, we're certainly we don't think that way, because if we did, we wouldn't have guys like Nick Hendrickson running the department. Guys like Armand Kuslevich, Graham writing for us, Graham Anderson writing for us, because these people, they are midgets, and they write fantastic articles. So don't let someone tell you that just because you can't reach the top shelf that you can't do what everyone else is doing.
Well, I mean, Nick can't. We had to buy him a stool for his computer, but it's fine. He's okay, you know?
Yeah.
Passable articles from him. The rest are okay, but, you know, Nick is passable.
Yeah.
Big congrats to him. He's about to get married in a month. So.
Yeah, no, congrats to Nick. He's still with the site. He's going to come back as a managing editor. He may take a couple months off to plan at his wedding and enjoy his honeymoon. And certainly we grant him that.
It'll be an exciting time.
I heard they're going to Smurf Village.
I want to send his wife a medal, or wife-to-be a medal, because I mean, she's got to put up with him all the time. I assume lift him up to things all the time. She must be ripped.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is... I've heard the honeymoon's at Smurf Village. I don't know about that for sure. It may be at the Shire.
The good news is you get a double bed and you just sleep foot to head, you know, each way, and it's fine. He doesn't take up that much room.
No, exactly. So they will, good luck to them and that, but we had to throw in a couple mentions. I know Armand has been saying we don't mention him on the podcast, so I made sure that we got him a mention in this week.
He'll come back up at the end when we throw out all those pieces too.
Yeah. But
no, we think David Desharnais off to the KHL.
You know, I thought he had a pretty good season for the Rangers.
A
guy vilified in Montreal as a matter of circumstance for me, not because of his play. Because somehow for not one, not two, not three, but four straight seasons of Marc Bergevin's tenure with the Montreal Canadiens, he decided to enter a season with David Desharnais as the team's number one center.
I mean, that's not Desharnais' fault.
No, I mean, the fact that you couldn't get a better number one center for four straight off seasons and four straight seasons, it, to me, boggles the mind as how Bergevin still has a job. Not only that, he couldn't get a better number one center, but for the first 4 years of Bergevin's tenure, the Montreal Canadiens center line was unchanged at Desharnais, Thomas Plekanec, and Lars Eller, and all it did was get older.
Yeah, I mean, there's really no argument here for me. Just it was a terrible, terrible team, top to bottom. All of them are bad, but mostly the centers. But all of them are bad. And it's really not his fault that he was the first line center on a bad Habs team.
Well, I don't think they were a bad team.
Nope, they were all bad. All of them.
The conference final 1 year.
just throwing that out there for you.
The team was all right. It just needed a center.
Yeah. I mean, it still does.
Still.
Bergevin is a real fast actor.
Well, I mean, now it has another issue, and you know, mm-hmm. we went through an article to describe the type of defenseman that that Mark Bergevin needs to put beside Shea Weber.
And, PK Subban?
Well, a left-handed PK Subban.
You know, I hear those grow on trees.
Yeah, but he just needs a puck-moving defenseman to put with him. My big hope this offseason, listening to rumors of who's available and about crazy trades that might get made, there's two. One is Jacob Slavin. I'm a fan of his. And I think the Carolina Hurricanes may look to make some really big moves this offseason. But the big one, the one that that seems to be going, I don't think Slavin comes cheap. The one who seems to be going cheaper than what he really should is Oscar Klefbom.
Yeah. Yeah, he does. Oscar Klefbom and a 10th for Rastus Mr. Ristolainen was the rumor I saw. And I'm not sure I would do Oscar Klefbom for Rasmus straight up.
Oh, I would not. I absolutely would not do Oscar Klefbom straight up. But giving up I wouldn't give up the 10th pick straight up for Rasmus Ristolainen. I wouldn't give up Klefbom for Ristolainen. But to package both is the Chiarelli special.
It really is.
Like this is bad. And yeah. And you know what? I want in on that. Hey, Edmonton, we don't need anything else. Here's the 35th pick overall in the draft. Just straight up for Oscar Klefbom. You're that desperate to get rid of his contract. We'll take him.
Oh, no. They're moving him for Cody Ceci one for one.
Yeah, I don't know. Cody Ceci might be too expensive for what the Oilers had in mind here.
No. They can give us the 10th if they want. It's fine. I'll take it.
Yeah, no, I mean, he seems to be the guy who's gonna move in Edmonton's stupid deal of the year.
I love that it's a perennial event.
Last year it was Chris Russell's contract. The year before we got a two for one offer. They're pretty related, but Taylor Hall moving on and then signing, going out and signing Milan Lucic. But yeah, this year's Oilers stupid deal of the offseason appears to be Oscar Klefbom, and I'd love for the Habs to get in on that one.
I think any team in the NHL should be actively shopping Oscar Klefbom. He didn't have a great year. He did play injured, but he has the past history to at least take a risk on him. And if they're asking for a guy like Ristolainen or, you know, hopefully Cody Ceci, I think it's worth it. I think it's a risk worth taking.
I think what they really need is some toughness and defensive ability and character on their blue
Jordy
line.
Ben?
Well, I would do Jordy Ben, but I was thinking Carl Alstner.
You know, it's true. He has a bigger contract. Of course you were thinking that.
But I'd be fine with Jordy Ben as well. I'll even throw in a discounted David Schlemko.
Wow, you are generous. You know who he didn't mention for the Hurricanes, who I was a little surprised at, is Brett Pesce. Now, I agree that Jacob Slavin's probably the better of the pairing, but I think Brett Pesce is underrated for his just pure defensive work.
Oh, I love Brett Pesce. I merely was looking at the fact that Brett Pesce is a right-handed shot.
Ah, fair. the Senators, Brett Pesce would fit in rather well.
All right. Fair enough. Yeah. Speaking of the right and left-handed shot debates and all that, Armand did put out a very good article today on the missing piece on the Habs blue line, analyzing what the Habs have on their team, looking at what's in the system. And for those who are Habs fans, you've probably seen this previously. But if you're not a Habs fan and you're just wondering where the problems stem from, looking maybe at their roster and at their prospects, you've really got to break it down into right and left side, because it's so overwhelming. And it's strange that it's this way, because most teams are stronger on the left side than they are on the right. But Montreal is just so overwhelmingly stronger on the right side than they are on the left.
It's worth mentioning, too, that we shouldn't restrict this to just non-Habs fans, because if you're a Montreal fan, you're probably a little masochistic, so you should read it, too, you know? Really feel that pain. Embrace the sadness.
You know.
It's a great article, though. I can't recommend it strongly enough. I know he's really proud of it, and we really think it's a good piece as well. So, you know, if you're curious about the Habs, you should give it a check.
All right. Going, before we wrap up, Colton, there's a big tournament going on in your neck of the woods starting on Friday night.
Yeah.
We have the Memorial Cup, the 100th edition of the tournament, making it even bigger than normal. A team from my neck of the woods that I get to see an awful lot as I'm credentialed for their games. The Hamilton Bulldogs are headed to Regina. We also have, of course, the host Pats, the Swift Current Broncos, and from the Quebec League, Acadie Bathurst going to the tournament, the Teton.
Les Titans. This is exactly as we called it. You know?
Yes.
I think we only got Acadie Bathurst right.
Yeah, I think that's it for me. I had, although Sault Ste. Marie did make it all the way to the OHL final. But they fell to Hamilton.
We both said Moose Jaw, though, and Moose Jaw was out in the second round.
Well, the team that took them out is Swift
Current. The champ. Yeah.
And that was
probably, and they took Regina to seven.
Yeah, that was one of those series was probably the best series of the WHL playoffs. Those were both, they happened in the first two rounds, but they were tremendous series. Swift Current really turned it on the second half of the season, and so they didn't have the highest ranking due to struggling up to maybe January. But they really have proven themselves. They were the best team in the WHL down the stretch and clearly the better team in the playoffs, the way they handled both Regina and Moose Jaw.
Yeah, it was fantastic to watch. I'm so excited to get over there. I've got my credentials for the tournament. Thank you, Global News. And I will be I'll be keeping an eye on that, possibly putting out some stories as well, if I can work that as well. But at the very least, we'll be talking about it on the podcast and discussing that.
What are you most intrigued to watch up close and personal?
Oh, it's got to be the Pats Broncos series. Just the rivalry, the atmosphere is going to be so much fun. Swift Current fans travel so well. If you've never been in an arena where their fans are visiting, or if you've never been able to catch one of their games on TV with like good background noise, you probably don't know, but they have fantastic traveling support. And I think the atmosphere between them when they show down, I think it's on Saturday, is going to be a blast. I'm really excited though to see the Titan in person. Just them as a team. That's basically it. I would love to see them. I'm a little disappointed that Batherson was eliminated. My boy Drake would have liked to have seen him in person, but it is what it is.
Well, I think the player to watch for both of us in with Acadie Bathurst is Noah Dobson, mm-hmm. who will likely is a pretty safe bet to go in the top 10 of this draft. Don't know if he goes in the top 4. It might feel like a little bit of a reach for either the Habs or the Sens to draft him, but great two-way defenseman, was over a point per game this year. There's people who are saying he's a Travis Hamonic, I've heard as a comparison for him, and he's great defensively, but he doesn't have the offense. He was over a point per game, people. The guy has, there is some offensive ability there. And I like his offensive skill, in fact, to translate more than an Evan Bouchard, who a lot of people are higher on. I just like his skating ability a lot better than Bouchard, and I think that will help him translate his offense at the pro level. So I think that he's a player to watch for teams with a very high draft pick.
What year do you see him slotting after a good tournament? And by, when I say good tournament, I mean, you know, a couple first-star performances and a decent run to the semifinal or the final.
I think he's anywhere from 5 to 10.
Okay,
I think he's
fair.
in that range. It'll depend on what a team wants. If a team wants pure offense, then you have to look at Bockfist and Quinn Hughes. And you have to look at what Quinn Hughes is doing for Team USA in the World Championships, playing against NHL players, high-end pros from Europe, and the way he's handled himself there. Yes, he's 5'9", 5'10". We'll find out the exact height at the NHL Draft Combine. But he's a dynamic skater, and he can put up big-time offensive numbers. The comparison I keep hearing with him is a guy like Brian Leetch.
I'd be okay with that.
You know, so I'm at the point, given his World Championship performance, I've moved him up to 4 on my list. I'm strongly considering bumping him over Filip Zadina. He's
wow.
that good at the World Championships. The fact that he's doing it now at a high level of competition, a highly competitive tournament against NHL like competition, has been the second best defenseman at, you know, 18 years old on Team USA. The only player who's been better than him to me in this tournament's been Connor Murphy. And so I'm strongly considering moving Hughes up to 3 and thinking that his ceiling is a lot higher than it was.
That is some incredibly high praise. And I'm all the more excited for the draft now to see how that shakes down.
So
the one thing we didn't mention today, that we probably should just briefly at least, since we've got about 8 minutes left here, is the Minnesota Whitecaps.
Yes, a new team in the NWHL, bringing that league up to 5 teams.
If you thought Vegas was stacked to start, wait until you see the Whitecaps next season. That's all I'm saying. This team, the players who play for the Whitecaps will be able to play for the league and qualify for the Olympics in Olympic years. So watch for that. Because things are going to get iffy in those years. We're going to see a lot of power moving to the central U.S.
Well, here's the thing, too, as well, with the Whitecaps. It's more, in some ways, similar to the way MLS has brought in their expansion teams than the way the NHL has.
Yeah. You know, much more similar.
The Whitecaps were an existing franchise in the old Western Women's Hockey League. That league folded about 7 or 8 years ago. But they have continued to operate as a franchise in without a league, basically playing exhibition games and having some of the best women in the United States under contract to their team and playing for their team. And so they've got a ready-built roster already. They're not coming in there's not going to be the traditional expansion draft and things like that. They've got a roster of players. And so they're going to come in. I mean, they may need to add a few players to put together a roster that's capable of playing a full league season instead of the odd exhibition game here and there. But for the most part, their roster is pretty set.
Yeah, and I mean, their roster over the years has been fantastic. We're talking both Lamoureux sisters, women like Julie Chu. There's been so many Olympians on this Whitecaps team over the years. In 2011, they beat the Clarkson Cup Brampton Beasts. And Brampton Beasts?
Yeah.
Yes. I had to think about that for a second. I wasn't sure if I was mixing up CWHL and OHL.
Beasts are
CHL.
The CHL franchise.
Who was the Brampton team in Blades?
Yes. They were the Brampton Thunder, and now they've become Markham Thunder.
What were they in 2011? I feel like there was a name change. I'm not sure. Regardless, they beat Brampton, who were the Clarkson Cup champions at the time. I mean, this is a team who is not just some bottom feeder. There's some real history here of quality players, of a quality team. It's, you know, they're a strong team that's coming into the league, and I think this is awesome. One of the things that I saw tweeted out was Joe Pack was writing about it, about how in 2017, Danny Ryland, the commissioner, was saying, you know, they would look at Minnesota if they could get an airline partner. So does this mean that there is some sort of corporate sponsorship deal now where teams are going to be flying out there? It'll be interesting to see what this means as far as travel goes for the league. You know, are we going to see maybe a couple other teams in that area? Or are we looking at maybe Pennsylvania next? Pittsburgh or Philadelphia would be great.
Yeah.
Or even up to Canada, you know, if you're going as far as Minnesota. Yeah, Winnipeg for sure. You know, if you look at a potential merger way down the line between the two leagues, you know, if that corporate sponsorship is there, maybe that makes that easier. Or into Atlantic Canada. That's pretty far travel for a Minnesota team, but it's not as bad for the four New York teams or tri-state area teams.
Well, it's always been discussed and is always coming up is the possibility of CWHL and NWHL mergers.
Yeah, and that's just it.
CWHL looking at having teams in China right now. So, I mean, they certainly have travel.
I mean, they do have teams in China right now.
Yeah, so they have a lot of travel. Would teams in Chicago make sense? Would a strong supporter of women's college hockey like North Dakota, would that make sense?
Yeah, I think North Dakota would be a great spot for them, especially after they lost their program.
Yeah, you know, would it now that there's no North Dakota women's hockey team for the university, does it make sense to have a pro team there?
I think so. But either way, this isn't just exciting news because it's a fifth team in the NWHL. It's exciting news because it's another team in women's hockey, which is always fantastic news. It's another team in a league which has had its ups and downs, but seems to be growing in the right direction. Again, that's great. But it's an exciting time in women's hockey because we haven't seen a ton of expansion there in a while.
No, and as I said, the NWHL's model was all about those four teams being very close together. And now that they've got some travel involved, does it make sense to merge with a CWHL who does do the travel, who's got, yes, the teams in Boston and Montreal and Brampton now in Markham and Toronto out there, but you also have the Calgary team out west. So you had travel from then, and you now are starting to get even more travel with the Chinese teams.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic and one that I'm eager to watch as it plays out. But I think that's probably just about gonna do it for us. We've pitched Armand's piece as being fantastic. Christian Holmes is going to have a piece probably by the time this is up on the women's hockey expansion and what that means. That'll be worth a read as well. Ariel Melendez. I always have to think where the N in her name is. It's easy for me to say. Just had a nice piece go out as well on the Flyers. So, anything that's caught your eye recently?
Those are the three big ones. I know Brian Oakley has done some looks at the Chicago Blackhawks, a couple of pieces on who their draft targets could be. Of course, the Blackhawks have two first round picks. So now that that we know the location of their second pick, which is Nashville's first rounder. He's done two articles, one for the Blackhawks pick in the top 10 and one for the mid-20s Nashville selection at players the Blackhawks could be looking for.
There you go. Plenty of reading material if you're looking for that sort of thing.
And also a piece on why the Leafs should re-sign Tyler Bozak.
Yeah, actually, that's that's a good one. Yeah, it's just a really good piece, and one of those things that'll make you reconsider it just a touch.
Yeah, because I think most people are assuming that he's gone from Toronto, but they certainly have the cap space to bring one of their free agents back, and here's a good discussion on why Tyler Bozak is that guy.
There you go. Check it out, lastwordonhockey.com. Always good content.
Mm-hmm. All right, Colton, I hope you have a good night.
You too.
Good night, all.
You're listening to Last Word Radio, where you get the last word.